Podcast People's Podcast. Hello and welcome to What Most People Think. Now, if you want context on what is happening in Syria, and if you want a background on the events in South Korea, where it was martial law and marital law, I don't think anybody else read it as marital law. I've been married 20 years. I thought, finally, somebody's put some rules on this thing. Then this is definitely not the podcast to come to, okay? I just want to reassure everybody, I will not be dipping my feet in those confusing, murky waters of international affairs. And as I bring in this week's guest, returning guest Matt Ford, I'm hoping that are you as ignorant as me, Matt? Are you as in the wilderness on what's been going on?
I followed it a bit, but not to any depth.
I mean, I listened to a podcast that the news agents did an emergency podcast, and I listened to that. That's as far as
I've been. Yeah, really. I don't really listen to news podcasts.
This is a shocking discovery right at the beginning here.
Because I think what's good about them, obviously, is that you've got really bright people who can put the stuff into context for you. But I like to do my own reading. So I like to, basically, the BBC website, the Telegraph website, and the Times website are my main go-to places.
I mean, the first thing that a listener will pick up there is that at least two of those are veering right of centre, Matt. When are you going to realise what you truly are, mate?
Well, according to my Twitter feed, maybe I already have. But the Telegraph is so well written. I get lots of ideas when I read the Telegraph. I just find it's really, I just like the writing.
You are pleasingly analogue, you know.
Well, it's the website. It's digital.
I love the fact that it's in the cybersphere, man. Were you surfing the web earlier as well? Do people still do that?
I was surfing. I used to buy the Telegraph in hard copy.
And how did that go down at Labour Party?
I used to read The Guardian when I was at school, and then just got kind of tired of it, really, about 20 years ago. I thought I'd rather... I also do think it's more interesting to read what your opponents think, really, or people who think differently. So I find that more stimulating. So I really like reading The Spectator as well. But the BBC website's good, isn't it? Because it's comprehensive.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I listen to the news agents is just to get angry, really. I mean, it's well produced, you know, but I like it annoying the shit out of me as well. It just gives me that adrenaline jolt. From the moment they go, it's Lewis, it's John, it's Emily.
Yeah.
I'm set up. You know those guys that just go on Twitter or X to get angry? That's why I listen to centre-left podcasts. But it's good to know that you do the same thing in the other direction. How have you been, Matt? Are you gigging? Are you touring at the moment?
Yeah, I'm on tour at the moment, about halfway through a tour. So I did an Edinburgh run, and then the tour goes on until April next year. So you can go to mattford.com to get tickets for that.
What's the title of the tour?
End of an Era.
Ah,
see, like the Taylor Swift thing.
I see. So how does it feel, Matt? Now you're shilling for the establishment. You shill.
Well, I'm still taking the piss out of politicians, so I'm fine. It's great for me. I think it's so good to have a new group of people to do the voices of, and just new people to take the mick out of. You know, whether I agree with them or not, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to do things that are silly and funny. And instead of having to go back to the Tory well, you know, every, you know, it's just 14 years of it. My God, you know.
14 years. I mean, he's done very well for that to just become a phrase. I'm not sure all of it was chaos, but he certainly planted that seed in the mind. And I mean, look, you always took the piss out of all people, but I suppose the reason I said it was because when the Tories were in power, the presumption was among a certain group of people was that all I would do was go on stage and say how great the governing party were, but that's not really comedy, is it? It's a rally.
No, and I think as long as you make it funny, then it is comedy. But obviously there's stuff the government's doing that I really agree with. So it would be daft for me to, for the sake of it, go, oh, well, yeah, aren't they rubbish? When I'm clearly more sympathetic and more in agreement with what they're doing. But obviously, I guess for me, because I do voices, you can still take the piss out of them for the way they sound, basically. You know, it's like Angela Rayner and Rachel Reeves and Ed Miliband and Keir Starmer. It's like a whole new group of people to do their voices of.
There is certainly a shared kind of vocal quality between Miliband, Starmer and Reeves.
Yeah.
What is there some sort of finishing school that Labour politicians go to where they just go, okay, it's all looking good, but we just need the voice to be a bit weird, a bit nasal. Maybe we do something to your nasal cavity. This isn't really popping for us yet.
It is weird that sort of blockage is part of that sort of adenoidal... I mean, Reeves is really interesting because she at the start of her sentences, she enunciates very clearly, but she's got really quite wild Cockney vowels. And by the end of a sentence, they really sort of burst out of her mouth. So you hear her say things like, "We will implement these policies based on independent recommendations." Like the rah, really comes out like a trumpet blast of a noise.
And she just sound very cross. She's very cross. Like when she enters the room, it's like, well, you've all let yourself down. If anything, I'm more disappointed. That is the sort of starting point for any Rachel Reeves interview, isn't it?
I think certainly what's happened with Labour is they've inherited such a serious situation and they're serious people who want to sort it out that I guess for them it doesn't feel like the time to be being all loose and having a laugh. I mean, you need to find the appropriate time to do that.
Well, somebody tell Angela Rayner and Wes Streeting, mate, at the Spectator Awards.
Incredible. I mean, they're so funny. Do you know what I mean? So that's the sort of place where you can do it. But I think obviously when you're in the House of Commons and you're having to manage a situation that is bad, then she's going to be sick. And I don't think it's a bad thing for a Chancellor to be seen as a serious person who takes things seriously. I think there are wider political benefits to that.
You're all very naughty boys. If Spitting Image came back like that again, like that would be the angle I would go. I mean, not in a sort of dominatrix ways, but you're all very, don't make me come in here again. That'd be Rachel Reeves's one. And listen, you speak about how, you know, the situation Labour find themselves in. When we last spoke, it was in the Labour, you know, it's that weird glow that lasted about a day where it's like, okay, whether you vote for Labour or not, new government, let's hope, you know, things are a bit calmer than they've been. And it's certainly been a bit more turbulent than most of us expected. So we'll be reflecting on that. We'll also be talking about the cliche that's now the rise of reform. We all have to call it that. Sort of sounds like one of those Star Wars titles, like Rise of Reform is the next installment in the UK politics Star Wars saga. But we're talking about, you know, what that means. Who should be more worried? You know, obviously the Tories on a surface level, but Labour have a lot of seats where reform came second. Then we'll be talking about US politics. I haven't had a chance to speak to Matt since Trump won. So we'll be talking about Trump 2, the sequel, what that's going to look like, and maybe making a few predictions, frivolous or otherwise, about his inauguration next year. And then in the Patreon only, as two topical political comedians rarely get together, we're probably just going to have a bitch, right? We're going to bitch about the shows that aren't on anymore, the shows that are on. Who gets booked? If you really want to hear, well, I will. Look, Matt is far more dignified than that, but I will certainly be getting my claws out for that one. Right, new patrons. Don't know if you remember, Matt, but the reward that people get for becoming patrons. I only got a couple of names here, but I think that these are good ones to speculate on.
I love
We've
doing
got
this.
Judy Murrell and Nick Silk. Now, I'm really interested as what vibes you're getting off that. Judy Murrell and Nick Silk.
Judy Murrell. Older, I think. I'm going to say, I think Judy's in her 60s.
Okay. I mean, I might have just lost a patron, but keep going. Matt said it.
But looks good on it. She looks like she's in her 30s. Judy Murrell. I mean, that's got a real... You know when actors would give themselves more exotic surnames?
Yeah.
Remember the guy who played Kevin Webster in Coronation Street was called Michael Lavelle, and apparently that was his stage name. And Anton DeBeck, do you know what I mean? Like, giving it that... Judy Murrell... I wonder if she's changed her name by Depol. I wonder if she was just...
It's a good name. It has a good bounce to it. Like, you know they say about iambic pentameter where... Judy Murrell. It works very well. I had in my mind a kind of East End matriarch villain character.
Ooh.
Maybe I'm pairing them together. Judy Murrell and Nick Silk did a lot of bank jobs back in the 50s.
I mean, Nick Silk, obviously, if you were writing a show about a Chambers or barristers and things.
Yeah.
Nick Silk has a Nicholas Silk.
Oh,
Nick Silk KC.
Nicholas Silk KC. You're right. It's so funny, isn't it? That some names, once you expand them to their full name, like Jeff and Jeffrey, there's no, like, Jeff is, as I've said before, it sounds like a Scouse plasterer, whereas Jeffrey sells Jaguars. Well, not anymore. Not since the relaunch.
Sounds like a dog.
Jeffrey the dog. Do you know, there's a weird thing I've been noticing when I because I've been talking about my name in prepping material for the next tour. And I say, you know, my name's Jeff. And then a lot of the young people in the audience go, my name is Jeff. Because there was a film called 21 Jump Street where Channing Tatum just pretended that his name was Jeff and said, my name is Jeff. So it took me a while to work out, but...
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I thought everybody was doing Borat voices.
Yeah, I thought it was a Borat thing when you first did it.
Nope.
Jeff's a lovely name.
Thank you, mate. Well, you can depend on a Jeff, I think. I'd say it's a very Labour name, to be honest.
Oh, God, yeah. Very trade union-y.
Well, my dad literally was, but then you got Jeffrey Cox as well. It really does come down to which version of the name that you use.
Well, if you become Sir Jeffrey, then it's very different. Sir Jeffrey Norcott.
Listen, mate, I wouldn't rule it out. So Judy Morell and Nick Silk, I think we're going with that they did a lot of bank jobs. But Nicholas Silk, KC, is the guy that put Nick Silk away for a 10 stretch. Domain talking point. So our super patron, David Domain, he keeps a track of previous shows and just picks up on odd strands here. I did a breaking news show on Friday, Matt. And one of the things I was talking about was it just came into my head. You know, one of those things you think, I literally haven't thought about that since I last knew it. Which I suppose is true of anything.
True of everything.
I sounded like such a bimbo there. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I literally hadn't thought of that since I last thought it. No offence to the bimbo community. You wouldn't be listening. So I was talking about Terry Major, John Major's brother. Do you remember that? He had a bit of a media profile, Terry.
I don't.
He lives very near my mate's girlfriend's in like such a sort of mundane part of Greater Croydon. I know Greater Croydon isn't a thing, but people know what I mean by that. The Wallington sort of suburbs of Croydon. Terry Major. Sadly, the news is that Terry Major passed away in 2007 at the age of 75. But I just remember him looking a lot like John Major. And you sort of thought with John Major's kind of like, or certainly seen back then, like the boring one, you'd have thought he'd be the tearaway, he'd be the Piers Corbyn, but he was just essentially another John Major.
The problem is with the Corbyns is they're both a tearaway. Like, who's the straight man in that relationship? They're both fucking nuts. I grew to see Piers as the calmer, more rational of the two.
Yeah, we certainly spent less time with dictators. Okay. This is one thing where we can always meet for, you know, that game of football in no man's land. We can always.
That was at Christmas.
Yes, yeah. We can always meet there and we can always give Corbyn a bit of a kick in. And the Lib Dems. And the Lib Dems. Most people think. I'm going to do a thank you. Well, it's to my football team, AFC Wimbledon. We won 3-0. Was it 3-0 at Harrogate on Saturday, and that was after a couple of rum results. We lost in the FA Cup to Dagenham and Redbridge at home, and then we lost a 2-0 lead at home on the Tuesday. And you'll know this, Matt. I don't know if it was ever thus, but football fans are so volatile now. Like, we have been in there or thereabouts with the playoffs all season, right? This after we had a few bad seasons, right? But what it takes for a group of fans to be enjoying a season now, it's really rare. If you look in the Premiership, I think Forest doing all right this year. Yeah, they're doing very well.
Yeah, beat Man United at the weekend.
So you're enjoying it. But if you look at the Premiership as a whole, how many fans in the Premiership are enjoying it? It's a really, I don't think it used to be like this. I think that social media creates these sort of, you know, the guy that used to sit behind you and moan every game?
Yeah.
He's now in your fucking ear all week long. Is it a fair comment that, you know, apart from the team that are unexpectedly doing well, like Forest, or the promoted team that aren't shit,
yeah,
that's about it?
I think most fans broadly enjoy it and just enjoy the kind of mad, crazy ride of either pushing for something or trying to avoid the drop. I think there's a kind of thrill and adrenaline addiction to that. I think social media, as it has in other spheres, has made people go, actually, there's quite a lot of people like me. Also, I think anger is currency and always was. And I think that was pre-social media, that if you're the angriest, then you care the most about it. And you know that, you know, you remember at school, people who got into politics early, the sort of angry lefties were like livid about what was happening in Argentina or whatever. And they use that as part of their identity. So if you're angrier, then you're a bigger fan. And I think one of the crucial things as well as social media was Arsenal fan TV. I think that people go, coming out of a game and calling for the manager's head, even if you've just won, is like what a fan is. And I think that like radicalised a whole generation of fans to go being livid and gobbing off and actually saying really stupid things. And also phone-ins kind of incentivise that, I think, that having a more extreme take on any issue. And that applies to football as well. Going, oh, we're shit, or hating on players for no reason. Ryan Yates is a phenomenal midfielder that we've got. He came through our academy. He forced his way into the first team when we were in the Championship. Been out on loan. And he has raised his game consistently over the seasons to now where he is crucial, really, to everything that we do. he went through a period where quite a sizable section of the support, the vast majority of fans love him, but were really on his back. And I didn't understand what it was. It was just enough of them were on social media being dicks that it became a thing.
I think there's a difference between followers of a club, people that just kind of look at it online and chip in because they want to be involved, fans who can be Arsenal fans, and supporters. I would always think of myself as a supporter, is that you just try and get behind it. I think we're called happy clappers now, Matt. Is that the phrase for us?
I know. I've heard that phrase before. Just like, what? Just because you actually want your team to win. Do you know what? I also think people take into football their attitudes in the rest of their lives. So I think whatever your relationship with authority is, are you basically sort of quite benign, or do you see authority as always a bad thing? And I think people treat their football club like it's the council or the police or whatever. Do you know what I mean? People have that view. They haven't got a clue what they're doing. They haven't got a bloody clue, this lot. They don't know what's going on out here. They ain't got a bloody clue. They can sack the board. You're like, you would say that about anything. You would say that everyone in charge is stupid and doesn't know what they're doing. That's not necessarily wrong all the time. But I just think people take their general view of, you know, their relationship with their father gets transplanted onto whoever the manager is. Do you know what I mean? Like, without getting all Freudian about it, there is a kind of relationship.
You've never taken me to Wembley.
You're not my real manager.
All the other boys got to go to Wembley.
Exactly.
I never got further than a playoff semi-final second leg.
But that's also a part of it as well, is who, and this is where people's, I guess, sense of themselves is, am I just a fan? Now, I'm happy to just be a fan. Hmm. I don't fully understand football tactics. I'm not particularly that bothered about fully understanding them. If I go to a game and people are going, oh, look, we've got five in midfield out of possession, I can't see that most of the time, particularly if you stood down one end. You're like, I can't see what's offside. Hmm. I just want to see us score a goal and win. I just want to go to a game and see us score more goals than the other team. That's really all I care about. And I enjoy it in quite a dumb way. You know what I mean? When I go to watch a film, I never try and figure out the ending. I sort of deliberately make myself a bit thicker. I'm like, I'm just going to enjoy this in the way that the people who made this film intended me to enjoy it.
Can you imagine if film fans were like football fans? Literally, 7 minutes in, the bloke behind you going, well, what the hell is he doing? He's got Ariana Grande playing Galinda in Wicked there. That's absolutely ridiculous. We see her first scene. He should have had Elphaba in there for the first scene. He's completely surrendered possession. Oh, the balance between humour is tipped the wrong way in this. The original Wicked... Oh my God, if you had that prick behind you, I was going to say the pictures, that makes me sound old. Matt, what is your fuck you?
Anyone who rings anyone when it's not an emergency.
You're a millennial, aren't you? This might be our divide here.
I'm just like, don't ring me. I don't need to, like, unless we really need to catch up. My phone rings now, I'm like, this better be important. I'm like, just WhatsApp me. I've got the energy to talk on the phone.
Mate,
No.
Do you know that they've done social studies, and what you gain in terms of social interaction from speaking to somebody on the phone, there's not that much difference between being with somebody. But the difference from that to text is massive. Like, you get way, way, way less from a text than you do from speaking to someone. It's good to talk. Bob Hoskins said it. Come on.
No, man. I like the fact that I get less from it. I want less. I work nearly every day. Do we really need to just have an aimless, meandering chat?
But is this because of all that, you know, you do these great podcasts, you do British Scandal. Is it because your job has partly become discussion, that you don't want to discuss anything in real life?
I'm trying to save the moneymaker. I'm like, my throat is my livelihood. Don't dry it out.
Yeah, I don't want to waste good ideas in the midst of this chat. If I'm going to say a good idea on the phone, I then want to thank our program sponsors. And that observation about our mate Steve was brought to you by Blue Square.
Yeah. This conversation is sponsored by BetterHelp, which you'll need to use after you fucking ring me. Jesus Christ. Come on, man. Just text me. Just WhatsApp it. It's never that important, is it? So when the phone rings, I'm like, this has to be an emergency now.
Okay. So, all right. Don't ring Matt Ford.
Just don't ring anyone, ever.
Unless there's been a murder.
I can email it.
I like how angry you've got here. Well, listen, now we're in this space. I mean, you'll remember there was a famous, within the history of this podcast, appearance where you popped off about the Tories and I got in trouble with my listeners for not pushing back enough. So we're going to go talk about Labour now. And I've got to get into you now. Are we ready for a ding dong?
Yeah, come on, man.
All right, look, I'm not really a ding-dongy type guy.
Ding-dong merrily on high, mate. It's Christmas.
Exactly. Let's keep it, you know, let's keep it nice. But listen, this is the truth, right? I didn't vote Labour, right?
What?
But I know, mate. I know.
I'm surprised.
But I did understand the need for change. Right? I did understand where that was coming from. And I bought into, you know, the grown-ups said the room. But was it a politics that treads more lightly to your life? I genuinely thought that that was what was going to happen. I remember Andrew Marr saying that we're all treading a bit lighter this way. It's like we've had a big political shit. And we feel so what's happened, mate? You know, like I know it's early still, but I think that pound for pound, just for me, there's been a lot. And look, the suits and the glasses is more at the frivolous end of things, but there does seem to have been more tumult around the Labour Party than I expected. Do you share that? Do you feel that too?
I just think what's happened is we got used to politics being really chaotic and scandalous and uncertain and unpredictable. And I think it's really hard to wean yourself off the way that you see. It's the same thing we're saying about football areas. Once you're set that politics is this thing that's always mental, and then the media in that habit, and so are the public. So when it's not, you're like, well, it would take a while, I think, for people to settle down to the fact that actually this government isn't like that. And covering every little disagreement like it's, oh, well, we've got to cover it like this because we did this with Boris and Truss and whatever else. I think it slightly rings a bit hollow. And the crucial
I'll take your point to a point, but you know, like Sue Gray, there was briefing against her from day one. You know, that was a big thing. The director of staff going, that's it.
I mean, these are like back office staff stuff. It's not like
Sue Gray's was not the back office.
Well, of course she's not a politician. She's not front line.
But it was a senior position within this Labour government. And also, I think Starmer had spent a bit of political capital getting her in. It did feel like Morgan McSweeney was clearly the driving force. And then it was almost like, wouldn't it be fun to troll the Tories by getting Sue Gray in? Same as that Natalie Elphick defection. You know, you got a ministerial resignation. I mean, the thing that I've got to be honest with, that surprised me most was like the sort of handling of the comms around pensioners, farmers, and the NI rise. You know, these are the real things of politics, I think. Some of the other stuff is just noise. And I've said this on the podcast before, but the way that they sort of didn't lay any political track for the winter fuel thing, said it, and then it was recess. I just thought it's mental. You had so long to have a run-up, and they fluffed that so badly.
I think the issue is on policy, I agree with them. Universal benefits have a real issue with, as have Tories since since forever, is when the Tories were saying we've got to take difficult decisions, they were taking benefits away from the poorest. You know, they could live with that hard-headed thing. Labour are taking benefits away from the richest, and now people are in uproar. And you think, well, hang on a minute. If we agree that in times of difficulty you have to take difficult decisions and not everyone can win, surely it's fairer that the wealthiest lose out a little bit more. That makes more sense to me, that people who don't need something shouldn't get it.
But people would sort of dispute, because I've got friends whose, you know, their parents are not well and they're losing the benefit. And I know there's this stuff of getting on universal credit or pensioner credit. The point I mean is that they didn't create an argument before it happened. You know, it was an in-year change. It felt like sledgehammer to crack a nut. And I just think it took people by surprise, and it might end up being one of the most memorable things about this government.
I mean, if it is, then great, because it's actually a relatively small thing.
Yeah.
If that's the biggest problem they've created.
I suppose, yeah, defeating the 3-day war against Russia might be worse.
Yeah, so you think, I agree with you about the political management of it. And I think that's the difference really between the politics and the policy is, I think the policies people broadly agree with. And I think people would still broadly trust Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer with the economy. And I think in a way the budget was good because it said, right, we're going to go through these difficult stages in order to get here. And we'll go, right, okay, walk me through it. And I think that's one of the things that I really learned from working in politics was you have to be telling people all the time. You have to be explaining why things are happening, and you have to tell them that we are doing this in order to get to this point. And that point has to be expressed in language that isn't about billions more in the NHS. It has to be about, you will get an appointment within 4 weeks or whatever promise is.
Yeah, and the stuff about police and all that stuff.
It has to be broken down like that. We're going to go through this. Some people are going to have to pay more. No one expects you to be able to get anything for free. Like, remind people even of the basics that they know themselves. Frame it in that way. Everyone knows the country's fucked. Everyone knows you can't get anything for free. Some people are going to lose some benefits. Some people are going to have to pay a bit more in tax. We've been really thoughtful about who should pay more. We've closed the VAT loophole on private schools, etc. And that gets us to a position where You will get a GP in appointment within 8 weeks. You will have better GCSE results.
What most people think.
But you're sympathetic to that message. You're listening to that message, whereas the public are hearing the sort of the louder stuff. And I don't know if you can put it fully on the public, because there is some of them, like, you know, the budget stuff. Obviously, they wanted to clear the decks to do the things that they wanted to do. But, you know, even today, there's, you know, from KPMG, there's news about hiring. You know, the inflation's ticked up, unemployment's ticked up, growth has slowed, consumer confidence has done down. Their messaging materially made the economy worse. Now, it might be a short-term effect because people were unsure. But it's just not good politics. If the point is, if the economy contracts and there's less people in work, whatever they've made through the NI rise could be offset by the economy taking a turn for the worse. And just, I suppose what people wanted was just a period where maybe no one thought it was going to be a things can only get better, but just like things could just marginally stabilise.
But they are. So public sector pay rises, which has almost gone unreported, really. In fact, that's been presented by some of Labour's political opponents as a bad thing, a sort of caving into their union paymasters. Millions of people in this country have finally been given the pay rise that they deserve. That is a fiscal stimulus for millions of hardworking public sector staff, doctors, nurses, teachers, the lot, who finally are getting the money. Now, that is a fiscal stimulus as well as being a fair reward for the hard work they do to make our country great. And that work underpins a buoyant private sector. You cannot have a buoyant private sector without a strong public sector, because people take more sick days, they're less educated.
But did you think people, they would get more assurances on productivity? It did feel like just a bit of a layup. You know, we've had an election. These are maybe conversations that already happened with the unions. I sort of got, you know, like the Tories would have either had to reject those recommendations. Yeah. So I'm not saying that they wouldn't have had to. But I was disappointed that they didn't get assurances. It was pretty much a kind of blank check, really.
You know what I think as well is, if you inherit the sort of mess that they've inherited,
this feels like the Today Show at the moment. I'm loving it.
No, I'm loving it.
We'll get more lighthearted in a minute, but
once you've got, like, with employers, national insurance, once you're in a situation where you've inherited the sort of mess that Labour have inherited, you're trying to get more money into the coffers. Really, any tax rise is anti-competitive. Like, it's really hard to think of a way to get money in without some caucus saying, "Well, this is going to damage the economy in this way." Mm. So you're constantly trying to balance any harm to the economy against needing to correct. You can't just carry on the way that we were carrying on. So you've got to adjust course, and any incremental change obviously is going to upset any one group that is being taxed more or that is losing a benefit. I wouldn't lose sight of the fact that Labour want to build a lot of stuff, and that does not show up in the growth figures. So the OBR don't include those in any conversation about growth. If Labour do manage to get anywhere near building 1.5 million homes, new power stations.
Because that was the Tory target as well, wasn't it? I mean, it's a continuation of the same target.
Yes, but because what Labour are saying is they will overrule people. So Labour are being completely different to the Tories in saying, we will overrule local communities. Part of the reason why HS2 ended up being a fudge was because the Tories were too weak with their own MPs. Because basically, HS2 went through a load of Tory constituencies and all those MPs said, we're not going to back it. And instead of putting the country first, they put the party first. What Keir Starmer said, I will do the opposite. Now, that will come at a huge political price, because all those Labour MPs, where you heard, I don't know if you heard the Today programme last week, you got Labour council leaders saying, we're not going to build on our green belt. They can't force us to do this. It's going to be a huge political row, not just with their own party, but obviously with campaigners.
And that's going to be fronted up by, I mean, I suppose the positive for Labour is that we'll be fronted up by Angela Rayner. Yeah.
I mean, that's great for me. I mean, so, I've got so much material out of that, out of her being the person who's going to build all these homes. You know what I mean? It's great. I mean, that's one area where it's so good for comedy having her there. But what they're saying is we will overrule local opposition to it. That puts you on a collision course, obviously, with the Greens, the Tories, your own MPs. So Labour have a majority that what they're currently saying is, I think, well, we've got to do this for the country, so we're going to have to overrule these things. Now, that
take the difficult decisions. I mean, I get all that, but have they taken so many that they've sort of set a perception? Perhaps they've overplayed their hand. I mean, the speech. I mean, I'm just interested because you've met Starmer and you've had a beer with him and stuff. I most people say he's a good bloke in person, right? But I really struggle to get a sense of any sort of consistency of tone, at least, right? Like, when he was sort of said, well, I'm not saying drag the swamp, right? You go, well, you have used the phrase, mate. Like, you say, I'm not saying this. Look, it's almost a bit like going, look, Matt, I'm not saying, right, yeah. It's like another comedian going, I'm not saying that you overrun, right? I'm just saying that that phrase exists about comedians. And then he sort of, by the way, just for the record, Matt Hepford does not overrun. I was just trying to give you an example. But,
I'm very punctual.
No, me too, mate. In fact, can we just have a fuck you to comedians that overrun?
Also, I don't understand why you would want to. Why would you want to? You finished work on time. Why are you still there?
It's when they look at their watch, they know they're overrun. They'll go, oh, one more. Yeah. And then I've got a quick story. First up, you don't have to say it's a story. You just start telling it. Anyway.
Hard agree.
But were you surprised, like the tone of that speech? Because I just wonder, he's sort of like, if you look at Maloney and you look at like all the strongmen, you know, there is a sense that we've got our Colin from accounts guy and, you know, he's the kind of knife to a gunfight. Is he trying to posture a bit more strongman because he thinks that will help with the British public? Or is he really going to have a pop at the civil service?
Oh, he's ruthless. I think his allies and his critics would agree on this is a ruthless man. You only need to see the way he dispatched Sue Gray, the way he dispatched Jeremy Corbyn and dealt with those people. He is, at heart, a problem solver. And he has one of his great strengths is there is a sort of dispassionate pragmatism about what needs to be done in order to solve that problem. And he will do what it takes, and he's prepared to pay the political price and take on the political risk of taking very difficult decisions. And I think whatever you think of him, that is clear. That's clear on the winter fuel allowance, on the various tax rises that he's brought in, the way he dealt with any internal opponents in the party and any, you know, he will do what is required in order to solve the problem. So I think there's a danger that people underestimate him because he's a nice person, for want of a better phrase. Don't underestimate how ruthless he is.
So are you saying he's like Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction? You know, bit quiet, but he turns up, he disposes of bodies. Hey, boss, Louise Hayes made a bit of a mess at transport. Okay, I'll be over in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at PMQs a few weeks ago. Have you done that for Five Live, by the way? I mean, you've probably been at PMQs before, so it was...
Oh, man. I mean, I've been many times, and I got to see I got to go in the Blair Hay gears, which was...
Amazing.
That was the golden era, really. It was fantastic. So, yeah, I've been a few times. I love it.
It's like tennis politics, isn't it? Where you go, there's those vintage years. I think like when there's Sampras and the big servers, and then there's those lean years in terms of personalities. I think we've had a bit of a run of the lean years. We're sort of in our Stefan Edberg period at the moment.
I mean, Cameron was great at it. Cameron was
underrated,
so good.
Yeah, I would say.
I loved watching Cameron at PM. He always had good lines. He was really funny. But what you do get from it, and I don't know if you thought this when you went, you do get a sense of how the parliamentary parties feel about their leaders.
Totally.
And you can see from the Tories, they're just so deflated. They're not behind Kemi Badenoch at all. The morale is low. I mean, there's only 120 of them. There's a lot of space in between. You know, you see those Labour benches and they're crammed in. Yeah. There's so much space in between the shoulders of the Tories. They look completely deflated. Now, Labour were in that position after the last election and they just won a landslide. So it doesn't mean they can't turn it round. But at the moment, you go,
but 120, I mean, I think there's a big difference. What was Labour? They're 230 at the last election or something, which is it's about double the size, right? But when I was there, one of the things that I thought isn't good for our democracy at the moment is that you've got this kind of, what was it, they say, mile wide, inch deep thing going on with Labour's majority. But not just that, you've got all these Lib Dem MPs and Ed Davey and Keir Starmer are clearly the kind of guys that they probably go to the same cycling club. You know what I mean? There's so obviously a Venn diagram between them. Ed Davey almost looks like, sorry, mate, I'm going to have to ask you. Is it all right? I've asked you a question. And you go, so you got the 400 fucking Labour MPs, right? And then you got about 70 Lib Dem MPs. You go, this isn't just like 400 plays 121. It's about 480, you know, there's certainly certain SNP, but let's just call it, it's like a massive coalition and they look isolated. I don't know if they're not behind Kemi. I think they're still in shock. When I was there, I just saw a group of people that were just staring. I don't know if there's a leader who could stand in front of them that would motivate them.
Well, James Cleverly, I think just watching that leadership contest, and I'm sure you did as well. I don't know if you went to the conference, but the four speeches that they did when it was Badenoch, Jenrick, Tugendhat and Cleverly, I think they've all got their strengths. You shouldn't underestimate any of them. And they all clearly appealed to slightly different groups. But Cleverly's was objectively the best speech. It was charismatic, funny. And also, he was prepared to tell the party difficult truths. And he clearly, you know, that thing when he says the British people never get it wrong, that is almost like my political mantra. Is that
even for Brexit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I obviously disagree with what I mean with that is it doesn't mean that I agree with who they always back, but you have to deliver the outcome and you have to understand why people voted for things. I think Brexit has clearly damaged our country, but people voted for it. And certainly for now, any sense that you would try and undo that is damaging. But Cleverly's the one they should have picked. So I think if Cleverly was there with his... Firstly, he would be really good at the dispatch box and just that morale boost. You know, if you think of 1997 to 2001, Hake clearly wasn't going to win, but he kept the morale of the party up.
Yeah.
Certainly in Parliament. Now, that was so crucial to the survival and the turnaround of the Tories at that time. And obviously it was a long game, but you need to keep people's peckers up in that point. You need to make them feel good in the wake of a defeat. Cleverly is so good at that in those sorts of places. And I think he would really lay gloves on Keir Starmer. Whereas with Kemi Badenoch, you just go, oh, man, we've lost. Now, she may, and I'm sure she will, improve at Prime Minister's questions. And it's hard and it's difficult. She will get better at it, I've got no doubt. But I think, had they had Cleverly, actually, the conversation might be a little bit different. I think you'd be going, hang on a minute, don't rule these guys out.
Maybe in this Parliament, you know, that might not be their leader now, but it might be the guy that fights the next election for them. With the rise of reform, so I was at that spectator party where Farage kind of, in an evening of self-deprecating funny speeches, he just went up and said, we're coming for you. We're coming. you complacent bastards, we're coming for you. And, you know, there has been, the noise has got bigger. So reform towards the back end of last week, they finished above, well, they were above Labour in a poll, so pushed Labour into third place, right? There's been talk of the investment of Elon. I mean, like, it just on a level of finance we've never seen in this country before that would make a massive material difference. Like, instinctively, people would go, well, the reform are on the Tories' lawn, really. Their tanks are on the Tories' lawn. But there is this stat about Labour, you know, 89 of their 92, 90 of some, there's some stat, basically, right? This is where it's not the Today Show. Look, right, there's a lot of seats here where reform were second to Labour. Are we overestimating this, you know, given what first past the post is? Or could this, in one parliament, like, see a genuine revolution?
Absolutely, you could. And I agree with you, they would take seats off Labour as well. The primary target is obviously the Tories. That's who they're really going to eat up because they're to the right of the Tories and that's where most of their votes would come from. But any sort of national rise for reform also threatens Labour. And you only need to look at the places where, you know, Lee Anderson's a really interesting example of someone who was a Labour councillor, worked for a Labour MP, goes Tory, goes reform. And you can look at that a number of ways. You can say, well, that's a guy who doesn't know where his head's at. Or you say, well, that's someone who is, you understand how he gets, and I totally understand how he gets there. I totally understand how you go from where Labour was when he was a member of it to where it was when he left, where the Tories were when he joined and where reform is when he joined them. There are lots of people like him who feel that way, who were Labour because they cared about their jobs and their wages. But they weren't culturally Labour. They never went along
with...
And
their communities, the community that was close to them.
Absolutely. It was in their self-interest to be Labour because that was the party that was protecting their rights and their jobs. It doesn't mean that they agreed with environmental stuff, social stuff, other stuff. And certainly when Labour got into a position where it was basically not a patriotic party and seemed more sympathetic to our enemies than our allies, that of course patriotic people would not feel comfortable in that party. So I totally understand how you get there, and I totally understand how, and it's similar to the rise of Trump, but it's distinct, how there is a sense, and I don't think it's entirely unfounded, that there are different elites, but certainly that one perceived elite is a group of people, and for shorthand, the BBC, whoever, the metropolitan elite, whoever you consider that group of people to be.
Can you just say that like Keir Starmer, though?
The metropolitan elite.
Thank you.
That they don't like you very much. Certainly, this is a lot of it's about class, is they see, certainly I think a lot of working people think that they are looked down on and they think, you don't like me, you don't like what I stand for, you're not particularly keen on the country and you're going to police what I can and can't say. I totally understand why Nigel Farage appeals to people. I totally understand that. And I don't think that the sort of seeds of that analysis are always necessarily completely wrong. I think that there is an issue on the left and on the liberal left of looking down at the way we talked about people after Brexit. I say we, I didn't, but people on my side of it, this is appalling to talk about people in this way.
You know, I always thought it's because, like, it was almost, you know, selfish And evil, if you voted Tory, that was always the two ones, wasn't it?
This whole thing, oh, you're thick. Yeah, graduates don't vote, you know.
But if you voted Tory, you were selfish and evil, but at least you got to be like a sort of Bond villain. You know what I mean? You sounded like you might have a volcanic island. But then Brexit was like stupid and racist. You go, okay, that's not even a fun one. So I think, yeah, there is this risk. I had one of my patrons in touch with me that just had a chat with Nigel Farage, appeared in a photo, and then people made all sorts of assumptions about him and his son. I mean, just to wrap up this chat on reform, how well did they choose their name? Because I would have thought, if you went into a focus group, what does Britain need? Right? First thing, right? So we can't call it the kick up the arse party, right?
Change had already been taken. Obviously, there was
change UK. I think that's an overrated word.
I thought change. Putting UK on the end of it was daft.
Yes, change UK. What was they originally called? The independent group, the TIGs.
It was like the independent group for change, and then it was change. Just call it change. That would have been better. And then you can have time for change.
I still think reform is a more active word. It's like take back control. Change is like, you know, it's a bit more enigmatic.
But doesn't reform sound too incremental? Reforms like, are we going to reform the civil service? Going to reform this? I mean, I think the fact that it's Farage almost makes the word feel more dynamic. I think if it was a Lib Dem breakaway group called Reform, we'd all be going, fuck it now.
True. No, you're right. He does impose a certain identity on it. Just we've got to move on a sec, but there's loads of people on the reform side that are already they're not the ones, man. They're too moderate. They're too... and the fact that they keep getting Tory defectors is a bit like there was with AFC Wimbledon. There were some of our fans that when we got in the league, they were like, just gone too commercial, man. I preferred it when we was playing Hampton and Richmond.
Bonkers.
All right, we did a lot on UK politics there, but, you know, with the year coming to an end, I think it was a worthwhile thing. I mean, just on the US, we'll talk about Trump now. I need to know, because we haven't seen each other. Were you bought in at the end? You know, like when there's like, it's going to be close, it's going to be Kamala. Because I thought for a long time Kamala hadn't done enough to win the argument with the American people. I thought that, and then right at the end, I listened to fucking Rory Stewart, the BBC and all the usual suspects, and I turned right, and then I was out in the States and I watched CNN and MSNBC and all this stuff, and I'm so ashamed. Where was your head at? Did you think Trump was going to win?
I just think it's so hard from here to know, and I think the danger with, and that's where Rory Stewart came unstuck, is if you don't really know enough about American politics, you try and transplant your British analysis onto them, and they've got a different system, and there are different forces at play, there are different debates. So you then basically have to go with your gut and think, if I was in America, who would I vote for? And not just who would I? You know, you try and think, really, who? I just think Trump is such a formidable opponent. He's such a formidable opponent. He's so established. Biden clinging on did so much damage that I think the only thing I thought was Trump's already lost. He's deteriorated since that defeat. Maybe that means that he loses again.
But when he handed out a McDonald's, he looked very jolly.
Oh, he did. He looked great.
So jolly. I was saying for ages, I was saying, all you got to do is be America's dad. I would have said once upon a time, be Bill Cosby, but obviously not in that way. But just seem avuncular, patriot, just reassure people. And I think, I suppose maybe did more of that than perhaps we realised. It wasn't perhaps as unhinged as Trump has been in the past. I don't know if you've seen today, there's an image of him meeting Macron. Remember the Trump handshakes?
Oh, yeah.
Alfred, everyone should check this out. There's like an... there's like an air arm wrestle between the two of them.
Amazing.
Like they're literally arm wrestling. It's like Stallone in Over the Top. It's fucking hysterical. So this is where I say, you know, to people, I was always risk the wrath of like, you know, a kind of London comedy room by saying, look, I do think Trump is a prick, but I'm fond of him because of the content that he's provided. Like any great content provider over the years, he's given me moments. If you look at him as entertainment, I mean, you know, with that US campaign, you know, there was all the kind of establishment celebs on one side. There was Trump going out of the UFC. I mean, that clip of him walking out of UFC, it does look badass. I mean, whatever you think about the man.
Yeah.
Why is US politics so much sexier? I understand there's more people, more money, but the degree to which it's sexier, it's like we're not even playing the same sport here.
Because it's a different country and it's more powerful. And also, politics doesn't exist in a vacuum. You're talking about a country that's Hollywood. You know, people who make campaign videos will have worked on films. People who make campaign videos here might have worked on EastEnders and Coronation Street, which is my party political broadcasts. replicate that language and those the way
fucking
we shoot
miserable
things.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah, think of the way American TV is shot with that beautiful warm sheen on it. You know, it's far.
Could you sorry to ask you to do an impression, but I was just trying to think of you know that I am so and so and I approve this message.
Yeah.
Could Rishi have done that? I could never do a Rishi voice, but
I always thought the word actually was what got me in. Actually. Look, I want to pay tribute to actually the work that Jeff has done, and I think you've done a great job. I'd sort of dial him up a bit and make him a bit more nasally, but look, I think actually you've done a great thing. You know, meh, sort of noise.
I am Rishi Sunak, but is there a UK politician that could do that? I am Donald J. Trump and I approve this message. It just, there's something glamorous about that because you're sort of saying, I'm so fucking important. That even me saying this is all right is a big deal in itself. Like we would piss ourselves laughing if Starmer said that.
Oh, yeah, because the format's Starmer. Different. So they're used to it over there. You know, they're used to adverts over there for like paracetamol where it's like side effects may include suicidal thoughts. You're like, what? So much about it is batshit over there. So then the politics reflects that. And Trump is really entertaining, and that's part of his appeal. And that's something that none of his supporters really have. J.D. Vance isn't entertaining, and even Trump's offspring aren't. Trump has a special mix of things, which is obviously culturally, he's right-wing, and he says things that are culturally conservative that people like. People will trust him more on the economy as well. But also, he is entertaining. He is funny, and it's not just that we're laughing at him. He knows how to make us laugh. Even people like you and me who are politically opposed to him, he knows how to tickle us. He is a funny dude.
Well, on that note, you know, just to wrap up this section, any predictions for the inauguration? Crowd size, up or down on last time?
Up on his one. Up on his, yeah.
Up on his last time, but which was still the greatest, the biggest ever. So I don't know how he's going to top the biggest crowd size for anything that's ever happened. Who's going to sing? Kid Rock or Joe Rogan? Maybe Joe Rogan do karaoke? Okay, given that we're two topical comedians now, we're going to talk about the state of topical comedy. And by that, I mean we're going to have a right old bitch, probably, over, you know, like two northern women in the 50s, over the garden fence. And so that'll be, if you want to join the Patreon and get access to that, you can do that now. Okay, a bit of a long one this week. Matt Ford, thanks so much. It was just good to pick your brain about where your head's at on politics, because sadly, the circuit being what it is, we never fucking see each other anymore. It's just how comedy is now. Just remind us where people can see you, though.
So I'm doing the Bloomsbury Theatre on the 14th of December, and then my national tour continues through to April next year all over the country. You can go to mattford.com to get tickets. And Jeff, it is always a pleasure coming on. You're a lovely man.
There you go, mate. That was as close as I'll ever get to Frost Nixon. But well-meaning inquiries to where your head's at. But cheers for being on the show. And listen, we'll be back again soon with another episode of What Most People Think.